Morning, members. The committee will come to order. This is the meeting of the House Property Tax and Local Government Finance Committee. We will, members, on your agenda, in your packet, you will see we are going to hear from the Department of Revenue today. We have people here from out of town to testify for some of the bills that we have before, so we're going to switch the agenda around. We're going to move the item 5 or V to the very top of the substantive part of the agenda. And we're going to preface that, actually. Ms. Scheel is going to give us a quick overview on revenue estimates and fiscal notes. And so she'll give us kind of a primer there. And then we will begin with Representative Pepin and her bill. Okay, members, let's show our attention to Ms. Scheel now, and she'll lead us in this discussion. Ms. Scheel?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Because we have three bills on our agenda and how we do fiscal tracking, I want to draw your attention. This passout should be in your packet. If you don't have one, we have copies being made right now. And what I want to do is go over the background for what a revenue estimate is, what a fiscal note is, and what a local impact note is. They are all different, and that's why we're taking this short while right now to review them. A revenue estimate is an estimate by the Department of Revenue, not the Office of Minnesota Management and Budget. It provides analysis about how bill language would change state tax collections or state expenditures for property tax relief programs. It does not estimate how much the bill would affect a state agency or local government administrative costs. So a revenue estimate is an impact on the revenues, whether positive or negative. It provides an explanation of the estimating methodology used, including comments on the interpretation of statutory language. It's based on the most recent forecast, which right now is the November 2014 forecast. We'll have an update when the February forecast 2015 comes to us in the next few weeks. In general, estimates provide a static analysis, but sometimes behavioral responses are taken into account. And there are two examples that are in this packet. Mostly for the property tax division, some behavioral responses can be in terms of property tax interactions, and it's where you have a modification of a tax or a tax credit occurs, and at the time it can have a direct impact on other things that we are tracking in the budget. As an example, property tax estimates often include estimates for interactions when property tax increases may result in an increase in itemized income tax deductions. They do not, a revenue estimate does not account for secondary impacts such as an economic impact of a particular project. And they generally include 100% compliance. How to get a revenue estimate? To request an official estimate, you can come to your fiscal analyst, which is me for this division, or Cynthia Templin, who is my counterpart who also does taxes. Revenue estimates are prepared for all bills scheduled for a hearing in either the House or Senate Tax Committee or our Property Tax Division. And so today, as we have three bills that are up for presentation to the committee, in your packet in each of those green envelopes where you have bill information, there is a revenue estimate, and that is typically the structure that we use as we present bills before the committee. You will also have a revenue estimate. The timing for the completion of a revenue estimate depends on Department of Revenue staff's workload, but often they have those revenue estimates the day before a hearing. And so the packet that the estimates that you have in your packets, I received actually way before yesterday. I'm in contact with Department of Revenue as we line up the bills for a hearing. And the distribution is amongst committee staff and the author of the bill. So you will see that also as we go through this process. Department of Revenue sends estimates to the chief bill author via email and will be posted on their website for public access. So just to remember, a revenue estimate is something that is prepared for each bill as it comes before the committee. It is impact on revenues. That is different than a fiscal note. A fiscal note provides estimates of administrative costs for relevant state agencies, so it could be several state agencies, not just the Department of Revenue. And it's prepared under the direction of the Office of Minnesota Budget and Management, with the assistance of all relevant state agencies. In practice, a fiscal note for a tax bill need only be requested if the law change would have an administrative cost. For example, a new line on a tax return or page of instructions would rise the printing or mailing costs. We request fiscal notes when we feel that there would be an administrative change, and that is a process that I would provide for this committee. So I'll preview a bill's contents and actually try to determine whether a fiscal note needs to be requested. We enter requests into the fiscal note tracking system, and the timing for the processing of a fiscal note is different than that for a revenue estimate. It usually takes longer. It usually takes about a week. And we can track that through the fiscal note tracking system. So that's one of the other tools that we use to measure a cost impact. And then finally, we have a third thing that can help us determine the impact of a bill in a fiscal manner, and this is called a local impact note. Local impact notes estimate the local government or school district fiscal impact of a proposed legislation or rule. However, a local impact note need not be prepared for a number of different things, including if local costs rise only due to inflation, costs do not result from a new program or an increased level of service, the bill accommodates a specific local request, the bill results in no new local government duties, the bill reduces the local revenue by creating exemptions from local taxes, or the bill results in local savings that equal or exceed additional costs. The process for creating a local impact note is coordinated by the Office of Management and Budget with input from local officials, and it may take several weeks to process and complete. And what we have found at times is that sometimes there is a significant time lag because many, many local governments are involved in that process. The process for requesting a local impact note is very different than the other two tools. It can only be requested by the chair or ranking minority of the House or Senate Tax Committee, House Ways and Means Committee. The Commissioner of Management and Budget is required to inform the bill's author about the receipt of this request. So there is limited request possibilities for asking for a local impact note. And if you have any questions on any of these, please let me know. The last item on the pass out is the fiscal tracking sheets. We reviewed that last time. And so, Mr. Chair, that's the summary of my review. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to take them.
Thank you, Ms. Schill. Any questions for Ms. Schill? And she will be available at future hearings as well. So thank you very much. Members, we're going to move into our agenda on bills. These bills, by the way, members, the intention of the chair is to lay each of them over for possible inclusion. We'll start off with the Majority Leader, Representative Pepin, and her bill, House File 135. Well, she's coming up, members. If you would pull from your quickly from your packet the minutes from the last meeting, the chair at this point would entertain a motion to approve those. Representative Erickson.
Mr. Chair, I move approval of the minutes from January 14, 2015.
Representative Erickson has moved approval of the minutes from January 14th. Any additions, corrections? Seeing none, all in favor of Representative Erickson's motion, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion approved. Representative Pepin, thank you and welcome to the committee. Please proceed and bring us up to speed on House File 135.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thanks for having us here today. We're here to talk about an issue that's of a lot of importance to the city of Rogers. Can you hear me okay? It seems like it's kind of soft. Members, everybody here is probably very familiar with the Fiscal Disparities Program, except for some of the newer members. The city of Rogers has been a participant in the program since it came about. Of the 180 cities that participate, Rogers has continuously been the biggest net loser in terms of percentage. And what this bill would do would equalize the inequity that the city faces, because one of the things that the program was supposed to do, and one of the main arguments was, of course, it wants to bring fairness and bring all the cities so that they can have, you know, more equalized services. But the city of Rogers operates its own municipal wastewater treatment plant, and yet it's still expected to provide an exceptional amount of net capacity to this program. So, Mr. Chair, I don't know if you would like to. There's an author's amendment, and then there's a. I guess I'd like to get it in the shape, and then have the city of Rogers discuss the bill in more detail.
Yes, thank you, Representative Pepin. We do want to move into the author's amendment. Representative Pepin and members, the chair would move House File 135 for possible inclusion with the property tax division report. Representative Erickson would like
I
to
move
the
H0135A1 amendment.
The H0135A1 amendment has been moved. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. Amendment is adopted. Representative Pepin.
Thank you. I will turn it over to the city of Rogers. Darren Jekyll will start out.
Thank you, Representative Pepin.
Mr. Jekyll, welcome to the committee. Please tell us your name and a little bit about where you come from, and then proceed.
Thank you, Chair Drakowski and members of the committee. Good morning. Thank you for allowing us to be here for this important topic. Again, my name is Darren Jekyll. I am the acting mayor for the city of Rogers. I'd like to talk a little bit about the Metropolitan Fiscal Disparities Program and the impacts it has had in Rogers under the current legislation. First, let me say that the Rogers City Council recognizes the basic goals of fiscal disparities in maintaining a strong and vibrant region. Our concerns are not with those core goals, but with the practical application and unintended consequences of the program in some extreme situations. The city of Rogers represents one such situation. To illustrate this, I would note the following historical impacts per Exhibit C in our handouts. Over the past 10 years, the city of Rogers has contributed nearly $26 million in tax capacity to the pool. This amounts to an annual loss of revenue to the city of about $1 million a year in real tax dollars. The city's average tax levy over the same time was $4.4 million, meaning that the city lost an amount equal to 23% of its annual levies. A key justification for the Fiscal Disparities Program is that new growth is made possible due to shared regional infrastructure, primarily wastewater treatment. and therefore the benefits of commercial and industrial growth should be shared. However, Rogers is not served by regional wastewater infrastructure and is required to own and operate its own treatment plant at a significant expense and investment by local taxpayers. In fact, Rogers is the only significant contributor to the fiscal disparities program that is not served by the regional system. Yet, in 2014, the city contributed nearly 20% of its tax capacity to the program as a gross contribution. While we believe that more studies should be undertaken in regard to the future of the fiscal disparities program, we also firmly believe that this type of excessive impact needs to be addressed from a fairness perspective, regardless of other changes that may or may not be necessary in the future. To that end, we support Representative Pepin's bill to cap the contribution of municipalities which own and operate local wastewater treatment facilities, thereby not benefiting from the regional system. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you very much for your time and consideration. I would now like to have our city administrator share some additional details with you.
Thank you, Mr. Jekyll. Mr. Stommer, do you want to introduce yourself and for the record?
Yes, thank you, Chair Drazkowski. My name is Steve Stammer. I'm the city administrator for the city of Rogers. Thank you for having us today and for giving your time to this issue and this bill. We believe the City of Rogers provides a concrete example of the excessive impacts that can be created by the current fiscal disparities legislation. We also believe that Rogers is somewhat of a statistical outlier in nearly every comparison that can be made within the program. The most recent complete and thorough review of the fiscal disparities program was undertaken by the Department of Revenue in 2012, as many of you are likely aware. It was commissioned with the Tishore Bice consulting firm using 2011 data. In that year, in 2011, Rogers lost nearly 20% of its tax base to the fiscal disparities pool on a net basis after the distribution was made back to the city. That was the largest out of 180 jurisdictions. That was the largest net contribution in terms of tax capacity of 180 jurisdictions within the program. The second most, to put that into perspective, with the second biggest net loser in terms of net tax capacity, the second most impacted city lost 15.5% of its tax base. Rogers at number one at 20%. That means that Rogers was affected 25% greater than even just the second most impacted city on the list. And the real world impact then is that in Rogers, the city's tax rate, because of the fiscal disparities program in that year, the city tax rate, and more specifically and probably more importantly, local property taxpayer tax bills were 34% higher in Rogers than they would have been without the fiscal disparities program. A little more updated information from 2014, just a couple of statistics from more recent numbers. In 2014, the city of Rogers lost $2.8 million of its tax capacity on a net basis to the fiscal disparities program. That was a figure of 15.5% of the city's total tax capacity. Translated into dollar revenue loss, then the city of Rogers, with as Mr. Jekyll mentioned, with a average tax levy over the last 10 years being $4.5 million, in 2014 Rogers lost $1.1 million of revenue that could either have funded city services or amounted to a tax break for local property taxpayers. We believe there are two critical items that we'd like to point out with regard to our legislation. And those would be in Exhibits A and B in your handouts in the blue, the light blue binder. Exhibit A is the blue, the legal size table with the blue T shape across the top. What Exhibit A shows is a list of all cities that have been identified per MPCA licensed wastewater treatment facilities. This is a list of all those cities owning and operating their own wastewater treatment facility within the fiscal disparities region. The blue T represents cities that would be impacted by this legislation. So out of 180 jurisdictions, this proposed legislation would impact only these six cities that show a blue shade in their column. The key for the city of Rogers is looking at the third column from the right. And that column is titled Net Gain or Loss as a Percentage of Total Tax Capacity. And of all the cities that operate their own wastewater treatment plants and are not on the regional wastewater system, Rogers is the only city out of those 180 that is a significant net contributor. Rogers contributed 15.5%. The other five cities that that would benefit from the legislation here, from Bethel down to Belle Plaine on the table, they are all already net gainers from the system. They would have some minor benefit to the cap, but they are already net gainers from the system. There's only one city in the entire system other than Rogers that owns its own wastewater plant and contributes, and that is Greenfield. It's a very minor net contributor at 1.5%. The other thing I would point out is in the far bottom right-hand column is shown the total fiscal disparities pool for 2014 at $361 million. The far right-hand column shows the reduced tax capacity from the pool if applied to these six cities. And again, that would be the only cities that we've identified it would apply to. The pool then of $361 million would be reduced by only 0.6%. Therefore, we believe that this type of legislation can address the fairness issue in Rogers without significantly impacting the pool. The next handout would be Exhibit B that we would like to draw your attention to. That is the red and blue shaded table. Some of you may have seen this before. Metropolitan Council annually distributes a list of the top 20 net contributors and net gainers from the system. This is a list of those top 20 per the Department of Revenue and Metropolitan Council. And the item of note is that all of the cities in red are part of the Metropolitan Wastewater System. They are significant net contributors in their own right, but they all contain wastewater treatment facilities from the Met Council Regional System. The only city, again, in this list of 20 that owns and operates its own wastewater treatment plant is the blue city there in Rogers, near the top yet again this year. So to summarize those two exhibits, I would just point out that Rogers is the only city in the 180 jurisdictions that currently owns its own wastewater treatment plant and is a significant contributor. And on the flip side of that, we are the only top 20 contributor that is not served by Metropolitan Council wastewater. One item I would like to point out, you will hear likely from Metropolitan Cities or Metro Cities Group, a group that the city is a member of and very supportive of, but you will hear that group in general opposes changes of this nature unless they occur in the broader context of a review of all taxes and credits. And the city would generally support that. Rogers would support the idea of a larger review of the tax and credit system. However, we believe our example illustrates that there's a fundamental fairness issue with the city of Rogers and the wastewater treatment issue that could be addressed without significant impact to the pool. And the political reality is that if we wait for a complete overhaul of the system and a review of the entire taxes and credits framework, we'll be sitting here for years waiting for that to occur while the city of Rogers local taxpayers, homeowners, and business owners continue to pay a disproportionate share to the pool without the commensurate infrastructure support in return. And with that, I would just summarize by saying that we recognize, again, as Mr. Jagel pointed out, the goals of the fiscal disparities program in creating and maintaining a strong region. But we believe the extreme impacts placed on a few select communities should be moderated, and the legislation in front of you does that by capping the contribution to the pool for cities that own and operate their own wastewater treatment plant. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stommer. Is that it for testifiers, Representative Pepin?
Yeah.
Anybody else that would like to testify for or opposed to House File 135? And members, we'll do questions here soon if that's okay. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Patricia Nauman. I'm the Executive Director of Metro Cities. We are an organization that represents cities in the 7-county metropolitan area, including the city of Rogers. And I appreciate Mr. Stamer's comments today. We fully understand and appreciate the concerns that the city of Rogers is bringing to you with this bill, House File 135 today. I do want to add that Metro City's policies, we did take a very close look at the fiscal disparities program and our policy a couple of years ago. The organization fully supports the fiscal disparities program, and we do would ask that any such legislation, such as this bill, that does modify the program, be considered within a larger context of any property tax system review or efforts toward reform. And that's to help ensure that any policy that would seek to modify this program would be, that they're able to be a full look at the overall fairness, transparency, and equity in the fiscal disparities program. So, again, we appreciate the concerns, but our policy would ask that you do look at such legislation within that larger context. So happy to stand for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nelman. Anybody else that would like to testify before we move to questions? Members, we haven't. Members, we have not taken a look at fiscal disparities and the fundamentals of how it works. If we are able to carve out time in a future agenda, Mr. Hines is prepared to help us out with that. If members feel it's urgent to have that type of overview, please let me know, and we will expedite that and maybe bring that more to the top of future agendas. Representative Davney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Since Ms. Nauman is here, apparently fiscal disparities is limited to the use of construction of wastewater treatment facilities in the metro area. Can you, just since we haven't had that background, can you explain to the committee the limitations on the use of fiscal disparities money beyond the limitation for use of wastewater treatment?
Ms. Nauman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The fiscal disparities money is not used for specific purposes right now, and our policies actually oppose using taking any monies from the pool. The money goes into the pool and is essentially redistributed to cities in the Seven County metro area. So it is, well, with the exception of some provisions for the Mall of America, it is not diverted essentially. So.
Mr. Chair, just a quick
comment. Representative Davney.
So, Ms. Nauman, there's not a relationship between fiscal disparities and wastewater treatment?
No.
Ms. Nauman.
Thank you.
Thank you. And next on the list, we have Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to clarify the intent of the legislation. Is it my clear understanding, then, that the intent of this legislation is to limit the amount of money that a city pays to 10% of its tax capacity in the fiscal disparities program, to not exceed the 10% threshold.
Representative Pepin?
Yes, thank you, Representative Hertaus. That is the point of it, just because we feel the city of Rogers is such an outlier because they don't have the services that the other cities do. And, you know, clearly if you look at the graphs over time, it has been the highest net contributor. We feel that because we don't have these other advantages that the other cities do, that we're not saying that Rogers shouldn't contribute at all to fiscal disparities. We're just saying that considering the size of the city and the other things that the city does not get to participate in, that there should be a limit on fiscal disparities, a cap.
Mr. Steamer?
Yes, if I could add to that also, Chair, members of the committee, the cap would only apply to those cities that own and operate their own wastewater treatment plant, so it would not automatically apply to every city, but it would cap for those that own and operate their own wastewater treatment facility, cap the contribution at 10%. It would not adjust the distribution at all.
Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I just want to clarify something. I want to make sure that the intent is clear here, because there's a note on our sheet here relating to the city of Greenfield. Greenfield is not above that 10% threshold right now, but after a couple of years of disagreement with the Metropolitan Council, the comp plan was recently amended and is going to allow the community to add to its tax base by further utilizing an underserved portion of its enterprise fund, because the city of Greenfield does own its own wastewater treatment facility and has its own discharge point to the Crow River. It's noted in here that Greenfield is connected to the regional system, but I want to articulate that that's just a very small number of homes that are located along the Lake Sarah shoreline, and that was a kind of an EPA effort. So my point is that I feel that this community is going to be above that threshold fairly soon, and I want to make sure that this community is also going to be included with this legislation.
And with that, Mr. Hines, future cities that would come above that threshold as the bill is amended before us would also fall into that 10% cap. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that is correct, yes.
Thank you, Representative Hertas. Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you hear me?
No.
Yeah. No, your mic is
that one seems to have died.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Pepin, and all the other testifiers for your presentation and all the details. It's a lot of information, and it's very well laid out. I think you made a great presentation. I do have a question on the 10%. I'm wondering how you came to 10% specifically. Why not 5 or 15?
Mr. Stamer?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, yes, as we noted in 2013, 10% is not a magical number. It is a number that we felt that it would be a reasonable number to apply for a city that is not sharing in the full regional infrastructure. Any amount of relief would be helpful, but we believe 10% to be a reasonable amount. If I could address the question regarding Greenfield as well, that's one of the reasons why the city of Rogers and Representative Pepin did not write this as specific legislation to the city of Rogers, because we recognize that as cities move through their development life cycle, some cities may move in and out of this situation, and it would be fair to all cities in that if they're in the same situation to be able to have that same cap in place.
Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering if you would perhaps be amenable to an amendment that would change the percentage to something that would align more. I know you said it's not magical, but I'm just thinking, because municipal wastewater isn't the only benefit of fiscal disparities, isn't the only thing. For example, I know in my district, we have a lot of hunting grounds and areas that we won't develop, and all of that land will not ever get property tax from that, and people from all over the metro will come to use that. And so that's another benefit that, you know, it is hard to quantify or put a dollar amount on. So would you be amenable to an amendment to change that percent?
Representative Pepin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Whalen. I would not be amenable right now. I'd like to discuss it more. We just feel, I can't remember if we read off some of the numbers, but the City of Rogers did a memo to the committee, and did you pass that out to the
yes.
committee? If you refer to the memo, the City of Rogers contributed the following percentages of taxable net tax capacity. It's laid out on the first page. 2008, 19.01%, 2009, 22.08%. 23.19% in 2010, 24.6% in 2011, 23.72% in 2012, and on and on. And that, over time, has been a much higher number than virtually every other city. And we just feel that 10% is a more fair number for the size of the city. And, you know, again, we're not saying that Rogers shouldn't contribute anything to fiscal disparities. It's just that the city is an outlier. It has been over time. Representative Lenteski gave us the opportunity to present this bill as well in 2013, and she talked a lot about Bloomington, which is also a loser, and I think that probably the dollar-wise the largest net loser. And we just feel that Rogers, as a percentage, has been consistently over the last number of years the largest loser of the 180 cities, and we feel that this gives a fair amount of relief.
Mr. Stamer.
Yes, Chair, members of the committee, if I could address Representative Whalen and Representative Daphne's questions sort of together. One of the reasons that the city's bill focuses specifically on regional wastewater is that there are other regional infrastructure systems, whether it be parks, whether it be transportation. When it gets down to it, though, to my knowledge, the Metropolitan Council wastewater system is the only regional system that is truly funded with boundaries that coincide with the seven-county metro area. Parks is a great example, and we have the same situation that Representative Whalen mentioned in Rogers. We have a Three Rivers Park District, a regional park with Three Rivers Park District that takes up about 14% of our total land area, also non-taxable, same issue there. That is funded by Three Rivers Park, which is not a completely a regional park system. It's Hennepin County and a bit larger. Likewise, with transportation, there are a lot of regional transportation facilities. Rogers knows this very well. We've put over $4 million into regional systems over the past 5 years. But also, those are not, none of those other infrastructure pieces outside of wastewater are funded by the seven county metro area. When a regional transportation system is put in place, it is funded by local dollars from the city, from the county, from the state or federal dollars passing through Met Council as the Metropolitan Planning Organization, but they're not truly regional dollars that are funded using those same coterminous boundaries as the Metropolitan Council or Metropolitan Council area or fiscal disparities area. That is why we have directed this specifically to the regional wastewater system.
Representative Whalen. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that clarification. And I do, again, have some concerns, and I think a broader discussion of the fiscal disparities program would be more, it would make me more comfortable to as far as modifications are concerned. But I'll look forward to chatting with our majority leader about the percentage of 10% at a later time. So thank you.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And whoever would be appropriate and amongst the testifiers, I'm curious on some of the data over this period of time that it's, you know, this disparities have been in place. Approximately how much local tax revenue has been sucked away from the city of Rogers?
Mr. Stamer.
Chair, members of the committee, representative, I can address that. In Exhibit C is probably the best summary that we have. It's the last exhibit in your packet, I believe. Exhibit C shows historical impacts from the fiscal disparities program in Rogers. From 1980 to 2005, we have some summary data data that is shown as being every 5 years. City of Rogers has been a net contributor since at least 1980, we believe back in the 70s as well. And I would note that in as recently as 1990, I believe the City of Rogers population was still 600 strong. In 1990, when between 250,000 to $1 million was being contributed as a tax capacity number. The table below, though, has concrete data for a 10-year period starting in 2015 going back to 2006. Of note there, as Mr. Jekyll pointed out, the one of the middle columns here that is net contribution or loss by the City of Rogers, that is in tax capacity contribution. The city has averaged about a $2.5 million net contribution of tax capacity annually for those 10 years, so about $26 million over 10 years in tax capacity. The city's tax rate in the next column to the right, you can see, has been very stable between 38% and 42% over that time. So we've been able to maintain a stable tax rate. But what that has done in answering the specific question on tax dollars specifically, the far right column takes the city's net contribution and tax capacity times the tax rate of that given year, showing the actual lost revenue. And again, that revenue could be lost revenue to the city for operations, but it could also be in the form of property tax relief to some extent or some combination thereof. And over a 10-year period going back to 2006, the City of Rogers in real revenue dollars to the city lost $10 million over that entire period. An average of $1 million a year for compared to an average city levy of $4.4 million. About 1 year out of every 4 to 5 years, we're giving an entire year of revenue, city revenue, tax revenue, away to the pool. And if you can just imagine if 1 year out of every 4 to 5 years, the state of Minnesota gave away an entire year of state tax revenue, where we would be as a state.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And a follow-up to that, if this bill had been in place during the duration, if this was the initial language of the statute, how much, it's two parts, you know, that plus the amount that's being paid for the city for their wastewater treatment, etc. You know, if we had this lower level of local tax dollars being sucked out of Rogers, how is that comparable to what Rogers has been spending over that time period for wastewater treatment?
Mr. Stamer.
Chair, members of the committee, I don't have the exact numbers. I can tell you a one concrete example with regard to the wastewater treatment plant of the dollars more on the capital side comes into play, where the city currently owns and operates a wastewater treatment plant valued at about $9 to $9.5 million. Within the next 5 years, 5 to 10 years, if we can press it that far, the city will be facing an expansion necessary to that the wastewater treatment plant in order to accommodate development. We'll be facing a $20 million expansion. So we'll be having, again, a city of 12,000 people taking on debt for a $20 million expansion if we are not able to be hooked up to the Met Council system by then. We have discussed with the Metropolitan Council and with our Metropolitan Council representative, Katie Rodriguez, the staff there has noted that they will be looking at the formal request from the city. It's been talked about for 15, 20 years. We made that request on our comprehensive plan in 2009. We're making it again in an updated comprehensive plan amendment. So that process will start, but that would also mean the Metropolitan Council acquiring land, finding land, acquiring land, building a new wastewater treatment plant, likely along the Crow River on the border of Hennepin County. So that process could be 5 to 15 years to accomplish. So in the meantime, we're still looking at some relief until the point, knowing that at some point Rogers likely will fall off of the cap list, because at some point we likely will be on the Met Council system, and will at that point no longer be capped, but we will be receiving the benefit of the regional infrastructure.
Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Pepin. I kind of appreciate you bringing this forward, because I think it really highlights the need for a broader discussion on fiscal disparities going forward, and I do hope that at some point in time we can have not only the background so everybody's up to speed, but maybe a broader discussion about how we do perhaps make it more fair. But my question is, I want to look at the fiscal note that's in our packet from the Department of Revenue. And if I'm reading this correctly, and I think I am, because it's fairly straightforward, it's showing that what we will see if we vote yes for this bill and pass this into law is that we will see a higher property tax state-paid refund beginning in fiscal year 2017 to the tune of about $50,000. And I'm assuming, as I read the lines above that, that the reason for that is because as we pass, if we pass, a lower fiscal disparities distribution levy, the taxes are going to shift from the commercial industrial payers to homesteaded property class. Is that a fair statement?
Ms. Schill, you want to comment?
Mr. Chair and members, Representative Simonson, that is perfectly correct. That is, that impact is a cost. It's a $50,000 revenue loss. That's why you see in the upper part of the revenue note a negative number, but that is a loss in revenue, and it is due to a higher payout of property tax refunds.
And Mr. Chair, follow-up.
Representative Simonson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin. So I just want to go on the record and be clear here that if we pass this bill, we're really shifting, and it says right here in the fiscal note, about $400,000 annually onto property tax, homestead property taxpayers. Is that a fair statement?
Well, Representative
Pepin.
Thank you, Representative Simonson. You know, I would say that we need to look at this from the perspective of this went into effect in the 1970s, and to just look at what Rogers has paid into the system. And all we are trying to do here is to provide a little bit of relief to the cities and to the taxpayers, because we feel that because of the things that we don't qualify for and because of the fact that we have been consistent outlier, all we're saying is that we just think that we should be limited on paying up the max and capping at 10%. And certainly this is a system that we, you know, I would support reviewing, because clearly there are big winners and big losers, and you know, I would argue that the system really isn't fair for those cities that are losers to start with. And so I certainly think that this is a topic that is long overdue that certainly should be revisited. I think the formula hasn't been revisited in decades, and I don't have the magical answer of how to do that. But I would just say, because of the fact that Rogers is such an outlier, that we're hoping that this could provide at least temporarily some relief until, as Mr. Stommer said, until we're hooked up to Met Council. And until then, I don't know how long that's going to be, but we just feel that because Rogers has really gotten the short end of the stick for many, many years, and we just would like to provide a little bit of fairness.
Mr. Chair, one last follow-up.
Representative Simons.
And I appreciate that, and I do agree with you that the fiscal disparities program is something that we need to look at, I think, in a broader context. But again, just to be clear, and I did hear it, passing this bill would increase taxes for property, homesteaders to the tune of about $400,000 a year, shifting that cost away from commercial industrial payers. And my final question, Mr. Chair, and then I'll wrap up, and this is for Representative Pepin, is that does show an increase or a loss in revenue, I should say, beginning in fiscal year 2017 of about $50,000. And do you have a sense of where that revenue would come from?
Representative Pepin.
That might be a better question for staff.
Ms. Schill.
Mr. Chair and members, this division is responsible for a division report, and I heard as we started the bill that this would be considered to be included in the division report. If the division report included it, we would have a number of different items. It would then go to the tax committee. Each fiscal committee is given a target, and we would be responsible for meeting that target. Revenues could be raised. Other cost savings could be realized through different bills, but it would all come together with meeting our target, which is a general fund target. So it would be up to this committee or up to the tax committee eventually on how to pay for items that are contained in the division report and in the overall report for the omnibus tax bill.
Thank you, Michelle. And we are going to have a tax cut target within the tax committee, I suspect, and so this would be a very small component of that, I would suspect. Representative Hertaus, quickly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a follow-up to the testifier regarding the need to grow and expand the system, we really need to have a dialogue on the developing fringe or the very edges of the jurisdiction of the Metropolitan Council. The interceptors that are in place and the cost to extend them all the way to a community like Rogers or an Independence or a Minnetrista, Minnetrista might be an exception because it's already there, Greenfield would be another example, is that even the Met Council acknowledges that that's too expensive to do. And so they're talking about future expansion by discharge points to the Crow River, which is very adjacent. And so it really begs the question, do you need the Met Council for that? Would you rather own and control your own destiny, or do you want another level of bureaucracy controlling how your community grows and develops? So that's just a caveat to that statement.
Thank you, Representative Hertaus. Representative Pinto, and members, let's we want to try to speed along here. We've got two more bills and hopefully a presentation from Department of Revenue. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try to be quick. And I'm just want to follow up on Representative Simonson's question about the broader impact. Now, I haven't had the briefing, so I'm trying to make sure that I understand how this works. So as a result of the bill, property taxes in other communities would increase. Is that right? Like the shift from commercial industrial to homestead. Is that how this would, what the impact of this would end up being?
Mr. Hines can maybe help us with that, Representative Pinto.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Pinto, the mechanism is basically as you outlined it. I mean, the city of Rogers would not contribute as much to the pool. Therefore, every community in the metro area, other than the few that are listed on the list, would get less from the pool, and their taxes would increase on both their homes and their commercial industrial property. So it isn't just a straight off of CII onto homes. It's a regional-wide shift, but the net effect, it does end up falling heavier on homes this way. But the overall tax base just stays in Rogers. It doesn't go to the rest of the places.
So Mr. Hines, what we would see within that discussion is within Rogers, we'd actually see a reduction on both homesteaded and commercial industrial, and in the rest of the pool, you'd actually see a slight 0.6% increase across both of those areas, or maybe not in that proportion, but somehow amongst them.
Mr. Chair, exactly.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so it's, and I guess to understand, so it's not just on the residential property owners and all those other communities, but the commercial, all property owners, there'd be some increase, and I suppose 0.6% across, but it probably would vary depending on the particular community, particular property, et cetera.
I see Mr. Hines nodding his head.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Next, we have Representative Vogel.
Yes. thank you, Mr. Chair. Since this probably is going to come back to us, and maybe a point of clarification relative to Representative Whalen, if we could get some information on the relative cost difference between maintaining a local sewer system as well as being hooked up to the metro, that might, to some extent, clarify the percentage difference, because right now it certainly makes sense to explore this, but I think there's some struggling relative to what that that impact might be.
Thank you, Representative Vogel. Representative Davney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure whether this is a question for you or for the majority leader, but Representative Pepin's bill will increase state cost. But you indicated that this committee is likely to come up with, get a target from your leadership to cut state spending. So the first bill we're hearing in this committee, this biennium, not only raises property taxes, but increased state spending while you're anticipating a state cut or a spending cut target. So how do you increase state spending and decrease state spending at the same time?
Well, Representative Davney, I talked about there's going to be efforts, as I understand, in the tax committee and some of them may be in this committee, too, to look at tax cuts. And so this would fall, as I understand, into that target as it materializes. Representative Pepin.
But Mr. Chair, this is a spending increase.
It's
so House File 135 is an increase in state spending. While you're telling me there's going to be a spending cut in your target.
We may be getting in the weeds, Representative Davney, but it's also a tax cut for the people in Rogers. Representative Pepin.
Thank you. Well, Representative Davney, I think you're pretty familiar with redistribution of wealth. And I think, Representative Davney, what is the community you represent? Is it Minneapolis?
Representative Davney.
Mr. Chair, Representative Pepin, I am familiar with redistribution of wealth. I've been watching the rich do it for decades now. I feel your pain. Minneapolis is also a net contributor to the
FD
pool.
Representative Davney, I believe your community is also a large benefactor of local government aid as well. I think that overall the issue here is the whole program of fiscal disparities takes from some communities and gives to other communities. All this does is take a very, very modest amount to give a little bit of modest relief to those who have been paying an exceptionally high proportion of it. That's all this does. I think you're getting into the weeds on Representative Drazkowski's idea that we want to be fiscally responsible in the state overall.
Okay, and Representative Davney, before we proceed, do want to keep the weeds from wrapping around the prop, because the boat doesn't go very well when that happens. So, Representative Davney.
Well, and these days we don't know what those weeds are. They might be invasive species, so we have to be particularly careful.
Yes, and then
careful.
We need a boat wash.
There we go.
Representative Davney.
And a permit.
And a sticker. Representative Pepin, you say all this does is affect the city of Rogers, but that's not true.
No,
this increases property taxes across the metro area, Representative Whalen's district, Representative Hurtas's district. I don't know what Representative McDonald did to make you mad, but you took his community out. Representative, I can't even do your name.
Joaquim.
I'm going to have to practice that one. I had to practice Hurtas for a good year and a half before I think I got that done. Raises taxes in Representative Luncheski's district, my district. and increases state spending. So to say all this does is, you know, help the city of Rogers, it helps the city of Rogers, but at the cost of every taxpayer in the state of Minnesota when it increases state spending, and all property taxpayers in the metropolitan area when it raises our property taxes. So to say it just does this isn't exactly the case.
Representative Devney, before we go to Representative Pepin, sure. I'll draw members' attention back to the revenue note. It's a decrease in revenue to the state, and that's what we have in front of us. Representative Pepin.
Oh, I would just say, Representative Devney, I think that we should have a broader discussion. The other thing, getting back to local government aid, Rogers also does not get local government aid. And I think that you could look at the budget for Minneapolis, the city that you represent, and your city is a very large winner in the area of local government aid as well. And so I would argue that parts of the state are contributing to the base of Minneapolis, and that's fine. I understand that we do that. We help some cities out, and we want to make sure that all residents have a good quality of life. But I would just argue that the amount of money that per resident that your community gets compared to many of the other communities is disproportionately high. So I feel your comments are a little bit out of line as far as what my community does compared to what your community does.
Representative Devney, is the boat motor up yet?
Well, I'm just trying to understand how we increase state spending on property tax refunds, decrease state revenues, and come in with a tax cut bill. Because you're increasing spending and decreasing revenue, and those things, historically, if you look at Wisconsin, they've got a $2.1 billion deficit because they've done a bunch of that. You look at Minnesota, you folks inherited over a $1 billion surplus.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Devney,
I'm just trying to understand how you all do this.
This bill does not initiate state spending. As I read the revenue note, it decreases revenue by $50,000. That the legislature and the governor control state spending, and we'll move on. Representative Devney, okay?
We can move on, but okay. Mr.
Representative
Yoakam is next. Look at the last bullet point on the revenue note, which explains that it increases state spending.
Thank you, Representative Devney. Representative Yoakam, is that correct? Yoakam.
Yoakam. Think Minnesotan when you say it, and you'll be fine.
Thank you. Proceed.
It's a very tough one. Don't worry. I've been married for 22 years, and my dad still can't say it right. So, I think we have to look at I'm glad we're discussing fiscal disparities. I hope we go even further with this. Every city here has a story. I can look at my cities. 8 out of 8 years in St. Louis Park, they've been losers. 8 out of 10 years in Hopkins, they've been losers. Both those cities just received for local government aid back, and they hadn't had it for over a decade. So everybody has a story about how their city is contributing to the overall health of the region. And I'm all for looking at outliers and trying to even out the pendulum. And I'll be the bad guy in the room by saying if you look at the other end of the scale, there's a lot more outliers receiving than there are outliers paying in. So I think it's worthy of a discussion to have an overall view of fiscal disparities and to talk about it. Local government aid was just changed 2 years ago after years of study on the formula. So maybe I think it's better to look at the whole entire thing and the formula and how fiscal disparities are contributed to and distributed.
Thank you, Representative Yoakam. Am I in? Okay, Yoakam. Next we have Representative Whalen. No, she passed. Representative Hurtas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Devney, it's important to note that this isn't state spending. This is local money shifted around to other local units of government. And when you shift one of that burden to another community, it doesn't mean it's a tax increase. It means that the local community has to set its own levy to balance its budget, and it's going to know or be advised what its fiscal disparity payment is going to be. So it's a local decision whether or not you're going to continue to spend or whether you're going to balance the budget. So the only state impact really comes in the form of state aid to property taxpayers. Doesn't immediately translate that $50,000 is increased tax spending. or state spending, excuse me.
Thank you, Representative Hertaus. Anybody else? Representative Joaquim.
Just one quick point. I just want to, I wish I could dig out my notes from being on City Council for 9 years, but I think you actually found out your fiscal disparities number after you set your original proposed levy, and then your levy can only go down from there afterwards. So it does make it a little difficult for cities that bounce around between being contributors and losers.
Well, that's a key operative word, because it can go down. So city government knows it has to do that and set a preliminary levy, and then once they get the numbers, they can make the final one. And it can only go down, not up.
Thank you, Representative Hertaus and Representative Joaquim. Mr. Hines is going to comment. And the members, if we can, let's move on after this. Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, I think now, at least in the current calendar, now they do find out their fiscal disparities before the levy is set. It may have been in the past that wasn't the case.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hines. Mr. Stamer, real quickly.
Yes, Chair, at the risk of alienating about half of the committee, if I could take a crack at giving the city's position on the relative shifts that would occur here. And it is true, as the staff has pointed out, that with this bill, there will be some shift that does occur. But we believe that the status quo formula somewhat supposes that the ideal formula is already in place. The way the city would view this would be an attempt to correct a fairness issue that has been ongoing without going back and correcting and looking back over the last 40 years, but correcting it moving forward.
Thank you, Mr. Stamer. Mr. Jekyll, Representative Pepin. With that, members and Representative Pepin, we will lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the House property taxes bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Our next bill will be Representative Simonson, House File 176. Representative Simonson, if you want to begin as they're organizing here, introducing your bill, we'll be good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and we can, this will be something far less controversial, I'm sure. But some of you will recall in the last session we passed a bill that essentially reenacted what was an existing 0.5% tax on beverages and a 0.5% tax on short-term lodging in the city of Duluth, with revenues dedicated to a portion of the city of Duluth to improve spending or increase spending on bond proceeds dedicated towards improving essentially life in the western half of the city. And we had hearings on that, and we passed the bill, and the bill was signed into law. And what you have before you here is essentially a simple change that modifies the boundary of the district in which the proceeds can be spent to promote tourism and recreational improvements in the west half of Duluth, which is the district that I represent. And I have with me, Mr. Chair, Mr. Daniel Fanning from the City of Duluth, to briefly explain the city's perspective, very briefly, I might add, the city's perspective and why this boundary change is necessary.
Thank you, Representative Simonson. Members, by the way, the Chair does move House File 176 for possible inclusion. Mr. Fanning.
Good
Please morning, introduce Mr. yourself. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Daniel Fanning. I'm the Communications and Policy Director for the City of Duluth. I also oversee government relations for the city. Thank you for this opportunity. As Representative Simonson said, I'm going to just really briefly speak about why this is important to us. As the Representative mentioned last year, we were really grateful to get your support to enact to reauthorize this half-and-half tax, which is on lodging and food and beverages. This is simply amending it so that it goes from 34th Avenue West to 14th Avenue West, moving it down 20 blocks simply to include a neighborhood that was not included the first time. That's Lincoln Park. Lincoln Park is a neighborhood that is along the river corridor, which is what the intention of this original bill was, just to do some revitalization along the river corridor. The reason it was not included the first time was simply because as we were talking about the boundaries, we were using Wade Stadium and Spirit Mountain, our two bonding projects from last year, sort of as anchors as how we're talking about this region. As we were looking at Spirit Mountain, we realized that there was obviously a part of Duluth that went a little bit farther west than Spirit Mountain, so we included that as well. We should have done the same with Wade Stadium, going a little bit farther east. Literally, it's only 20 blocks. It includes a section of town that almost everyone would acknowledge is part of western Duluth. That is this area that's being affected now, and it very much goes along the river corridor. So this very much goes in line with what we were asking for last year. Simply put, we should have included it last year, and we are grateful for Representative Simonson and you all for taking the opportunity to hear us out on this. And as the representative mentioned, in the past, this half-and-half tourism tax went specifically to Canal Park. That's how we funded the deck, the Duluth Entertainment Convention Center, as well as some other improvements in Canal Park. Last year, we asked for the money to be dedicated to western Duluth. Again, that does include Lincoln Park, and that's what our intention's for. One more specific example of that is there is literally a park in Lincoln Park neighborhood called Lincoln Park that suffered some severe flood damage from 2012 flood. While we were looking at how, as we started collecting this money in August, we started putting together some serious plans on how we can use it to the best advantage that we can. We decided that would make sense to include some park revitalization along the corridor, which as you see is Grand Avenue, which turns into 3rd Avenue. That park is along that same corridor, which is where we're doing some other park enhancements. That's when we realized that Lincoln Park actually was not included, and that's when we brought it to Representative Simonson's attention and Senator Reiner's attention, so we appreciate their willingness to bring this forward. So, again, it costs no additional money, does not change any of our spending, except we're simply asking for the ability to spend the money 20 blocks east of where it currently is allowed. So I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Fanning. Members, any questions of Representative Simonson or Mr. Fanning? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And having watched the ebb and flow of Duluth's population and some of the transitions going through, to me this sort of seems like a urban renewal to try and revitalize the city that's had some urban flight. Is this project looking at stemming the flight from the city so that it can maybe regain some of its population and stature?
Representative Simonson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, I think the short answer is yes, but a little bit longer answer. I think that the days of the flight are long behind us. You see Duluth today is not what you saw 20 years ago. In fact, Duluth is experiencing population growth. We're experiencing business expansion to a degree that I've not seen in my 47 years there. But things are improving, and this shift, and as we talked about when we passed this bill last session, is essentially trying to revitalize that St. Louis River corridor in western Duluth, which includes both residential and commercial and industrial, with the primary focus being on tourism and recreation improvements. But yeah, the short answer is absolutely yes, but we're hopefully far around that path or that corner, so to speak, than we were 20 years ago.
Any other questions? Any questions? Representative Simonson, any parting comments here?
I just appreciate the time, Mr. Chair, and appreciate the support of the committee.
Anyone else that would like to testify in favor of or opposed to House File 176? Seeing none, the chair will lay the bill over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Representative Simonson, Mr. Fanning. Members, is Representative Carlson here? I think somebody may be going to find him, but let's move into the Department of Revenue. Folks, Ms. Eng, are you here? And Mr. Cummins. Okay, Ms. Starr, Mr. Cummins, you want to, if you would introduce yourself and proceed with your presentation. Thank you for coming today and helping us get a better grasp of the Department of Revenue's Property Tax Division and what you do for people.
Mr. Chair, my name is Paul Cummings, and I am the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. So, members of the committee, you'll likely be seeing me later on this year. A lot of what I do is interact with you all to talk to you about the policy ideas and various challenges and opportunities related to the administration of state taxes. I also work with legislative relations, and so I wanted to point out our legislative liaison, Amy Hang. She's a wonderful resource for you all, so make sure to utilize her. She's a really great asset for the department. Much of what I do is trying to work with policy ideas or what taxes could be or should be or tax changes. But the vast majority of what the Department of Revenue does is administer the tax laws as passed by you all and signed by the governor. We work to try and do that as fairly as possible to make sure that people are treated equally under the law. And as it relates to the property tax division, I'll just say that you all are getting a great value. There's a small group of people at the Department of Revenue that are trying to make one of the most complicated property tax systems in the nation to make sure that homeowners and businesses are being treated equitably across the state. So they do a wonderful job. I know as a staffer at the House, I would look with admiration to the folks at the Department of Revenue, and now as a Department of Revenue employee, I can say that I'm very proud of their work, and they are wonderful resources for the taxpayers of the state. So with that, I wanted to say that the person who oversees the administration of the property tax division within our senior management is Jenny Starr, a familiar face, and I wanted to introduce her. She is in a new role, and she can tell you about that.
Ms. Starr, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jenny Starr. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Business Taxes at the Department of Revenue. This means I oversee four of our taxing divisions, corporate income tax, sales tax, our special taxes division, and as Mr. Cummings explained, the property tax division.
Ms. Starr, I apologize. I should have said Assistant Commissioner. Thank you.
No apologies necessary, Mr. Chair. We have a handful of folks from our property tax division here today, and I agree with Mr. Cummings. I think they're highly skilled and thoughtful people who provide excellent service to the state of Minnesota. John Hagan, our current division director, is here. You all have known him over the past 4 years as our division director, which is only part of his 28 years of service at the Department of Revenue. Also, Cindy Raleigh is here. They'll come up together here in a moment. Ms. Raleigh will be the incoming director of the Property Tax Division here at the end of the month. Andrea Fish and Eric Ouellette will be presenting. Andrea is a supervisor in our Property Tax Division, and of course, many of you know Eric Ouellette, our Property Tax Research Director. We are also joined today by our assistant directors in that division, Zora Radalsevich and John Klocksim. So we thank everybody for coming today. In addition to walking through the major functions of the division, I really hope you'll also hear themes that reflect the department's core values and strategies, like integrity in our research and analysis process, leveraging technology in programs like ECRV and PRISM, providing our customers with the information and the education they need to have success in their programs. Thanks so much for having us today. John and Cindy will come up next.
Good morning. Thank you for coming. Please introduce yourself and tell us what you have for us today.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is John Hagan. I'm the director of the Property Tax Division for another 8 or 9 days. It's a pleasure to be here probably one last time. I'd like to introduce my replacement, Cindy Raleigh, who's been with the Department of Revenue for a number of years. And Cindy, if you'd say a few words about yourself.
Mr. Chair, members.
Ms. Raleigh.
My name is Cynthia Raleigh. I've been with the Department of Revenue for 12 years. I joined them from the private sector, so bring that experience as well. The last 9, I've been the Division Director for Tax Operations, which administers and processes a lot of the tax returns and refunds that are issued to your constituents. I'm very excited to be joining the Property Tax Division and to have the opportunity to work with you and your staff, as well as the county, cities, townships, and the great people within the Property Tax Division. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Raleigh. Mr. Hagan. Mr. Hagan, you have a presentation for us.
Mr. Chair, I do. Thank you. If I can figure this out. Briefly, the property tax is the oldest tax in Minnesota. In fact, the property tax had its origin in 1849, 9 years before Minnesota even became a state, as a divisional tax. In 1913, the first classification system was introduced into the Minnesota property tax, and that included a total of four classifications, one for unmined iron ore, one for household personal property, livestock, dogs, things like that, jewelry, fur coats. And so in essence, it only had two real property classifications in 1913 at its inception. In 1967, the personal property tax was repealed by the legislature, which was a great step forward for simplification in property tax. At the time, the real property class had grown to 26 classes of property in 1967, but it was, in fact, a very significant point in Minnesota property tax, where the county assessor system was fully implemented and went from a county supervisor of assessment system, and it was really the birth of the modern property tax system. By current times, the classification system has increased to 55 classes of property, and that's a bit arguable. Some people would argue more because of subclass, some people would argue less, but it's a number of classifications. And as Mr. Cummings said, it is arguably the most complex property tax system in the entire state, or entire United States. Our job is to administer the laws that are passed and make sure that people are treated fairly and laws are implemented uniformly throughout the state of Minnesota. We do this with 45 employees in the division. We collect a total of $850 million in state general taxes. We pay out over $950 million in aids and credits to the various jurisdictions. We oversee 87 counties, a number of cities and towns as part of our administration. $8 billion in property tax are paid every year in the state of Minnesota, which is, you remember, Commissioner Franz went around the state with his three-legged stool, where the property tax leg was greatly extended over the other tax types. And historically, in my 28-year career with the department, property taxes are sort of bought down by the legislature, only to keep creeping up again over time. And so it's always a battle to try to keep that three-legged stool more or less equalized. The major functions of our division are oversight and compliance, and we do this through education, monitoring assessments, monitoring the quality of valuation and the uniformity of classifications throughout the state of Minnesota. We conduct sales ratio studies to make certain that the assessor's values on property are within their acceptable levels between 90% and 105% of market value. If it is not, we make changes at the State Board of Equalization, which is conducted annually to equalize properties throughout the state of Minnesota. We also oversee the valuation of state-assessed property in the state. That means the valuation of all utility property, pipelines, railroads, commercial airlines, like things like that are valued by our state-assessed properties section. We work with aids and credits to make accurate, timely payments of local government aids to in credit reimbursements. The data information management is a huge process, and it's in the process of being streamlined. We're working on a new project called PRISM that will allow, it'll enable, I think we've talked a little bit about this in earlier years, but it'll enable electronic transference of all parcel-specific information to the state of Minnesota Department of Revenue, which would be a great asset to you as policymakers to know the actual wealth of various properties and on a parcel-level basis instead of an aggregated basis, as you've been relying on forever, I guess, since we were able to even collect that data some years back. We our research and analysis provides research analysis to support the division's oversight and compliance responsibilities for legislative, tax bill, fiscal impact, policy development, and to provide education. And with that very brief overview, I'm going to ask Andrea Fish and Eric Ouellette to join me at the table. I will be available for questions, but I guess because of the chairs, I'll slip back in those. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Hagan, and best of luck on your next opportunity to run the boat.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself. Ms. Fish?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, my name is Andrea Fish. I am here with the Property Tax Division of the Department of Revenue. As Mr. Hagan noted, one of our major functions is, of course, oversight and compliance of the property tax system. This is something that we do in order to achieve our vision that everyone is paying their fair share of taxes, no more and no less. As a broad overview, we can talk about assessments in Minnesota. We do oversee and monitor what I count as 52 separate property tax classifications that have specific requirements based on a property's use or size or the type of person who occupies the property. We have various homestead laws, special programs, which include valuations, deferrals, and exclusions, and property tax exemptions. Homesteads is a big part of my work within the Department of Revenue. Homesteads can be very easy to administer if we're looking at owner-occupied residential or agricultural homestead properties, relative residential and agricultural homestead properties, and then we move on to our special agricultural homesteads, which is where it gets a little more complicated. These are homesteads that are granted in cases where a farm property is not occupied. And we like to increase the complication there by doing linking, which allows for homesteads to be linked, non-contiguous agricultural properties that are under the same or similar ownership within four cities or townships of an occupied homestead. There won't be a pop quiz on that later. This is the reason that we have our infamous flowchart that we all very much like looking at that describes the many different ways that a property can have agricultural homestead. It is a complicated system. I myself am so thankful we have this flowchart. It answers a lot of questions. When we talk about oversight and compliance of special programs, this means making sure that all counties are fairly and equally administering these special value programs, these deferrals and exclusions, so that taxpayers are treated the same way statewide. Some of the bigger ones a lot of you might be familiar with. Of course, the homestead market value exclusion is the biggest value exclusion in the state. We also have the Green Acres program for agricultural properties. And another larger program that we have is the market value exclusions for homesteads that are occupied by veterans who are disabled. As with classification and homesteads, these further redistribute the property tax burden between different property types and property owners. If we're doing our job well, this means that we are administering the laws that you pass so that they have the intended results. For example, through the classification, homestead, and special program systems combined with the credits, you can see, for example, that the agricultural and rural vacant land classifications are paying a smaller share of their tax burden compared to their value than some other property types. So they do have 24% of the market value in the state and are paying about 8.5% of the taxes in the state. And that's through the special programs that we, again, are administering throughout the state to make sure that all qualifying property owners are treated in the same way.
Ms. Fish, we have a question from Representative McDonald, if you'd entertain it.
Certainly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Fish, I just have a request that I think it'll benefit the rest of the committee members. That flow chart appears I've seen that years ago, but I think it'll be very valuable. Would you be able to allow us to have a copy of that either through electronic and or a poster about 11 by 17 or bigger that we can put?
4 foot by 8.
I'm curious, actually.
Representative Hurtaugh said 4 foot by 8 would work.
Well, we want to save taxpayer dollars. I'd say 11 by 14 will be sufficient.
Ms. Fish.
Mr. Chair, Representative, certainly we can get you an electronic copy of that, and we're happy to have you print it in whatever size works the best for you in order to read all of the footnotes.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and again, if that could be either placed on or linked to from our committee site, that would be maybe useful.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Good suggestion. We'll have staff do that. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Fish, are these percentages of market value share typical across the state, or would we see variations from county to county, which I would think we would, because I can't imagine Hennepin will have agricultural vacant land at 24% of market value share. So is there a breakdown any place of counties when it comes to oversight and compliance in these categories?
Ms. Fish.
Chair and Representative Erickson, these are statewide numbers, and you are correct that there would be variations in different taxing jurisdictions. We could pull together some more regional or countywide information if it's necessary, but these are statewide numbers.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please, Ms. Fish.
Our role in ensuring compliance beyond just that sort of global making sure taxes are being fairly administered as intended includes conducting the annual sales ratio study that Mr. Ouellette will also speak about. This is through our State Board of Equalization. The sales ratio study compares actual sales prices of properties to the assessor's estimated market values to ensure that they're within an acceptable range. We provide information and education to property tax administrators and property owners, everything from week-long courses, seminars, and ethics for property tax administrators, as well as general information fact sheets that are always available on our website for property owners. We identify areas of non-compliance with property tax laws and address them and make sure that all counties are equally administering property taxes. We maintain comprehensive manuals for property tax administrators, two very large, rather soporific manuals, if you will, for assessors, auditors, and treasurers. We audit actions of local and county boards of appeal and equalization to make sure that their actions are also in compliance with state law. We conduct investigations of property tax administrators to address possible noncompliance issues. We train county and local board of appeal members. They are required to take training that is provided by the Department of Revenue. We're moving to a system of providing this training online as well. We provide an annual summary of the laws that are passed by legislature to property tax administrators statewide, discussing how to implement those new laws so that once again everyone is on the same page as they move forward with having taxpayers treated the way that they are intended to be treated. Some other division functions in the area of oversight and compliance include creating the templates for assessment notices, notices of valuation and classification, as well as truth in taxation notices and tax statements. So as you're receiving these in the mail, the original templates from that come from our office. We issue state deeds for tax forfeited lands, and we provide administrative functions through the State Board of Assessors. This board is responsible for the licensing and education verification requirements of the 856 licensed assessors in Minnesota. Moving on to our second major function, providing for the valuation of state-assessed properties, we value certain properties of gas distribution systems, electric utilities, pipelines, railroads, and commercial airlines. The valuations that are conducted by our state-assessed property section are more complex than the valuations that are typically a part of the property tax system. These are based on what's known as the unitary value, which is the value of an entity as a whole. The state-assessed properties section's work here ensures equalized and accurate values for these properties, as well as appropriate apportions of the values to their taxing jurisdictions, so that a jurisdiction has the right amount of tax base apportioned to it based on how much of a given system's value lies within their jurisdiction. They also handle appeals of property owners who disagree with the state's valuation. The section administers two production taxes, the wind energy production tax, which has been around for some time, and collected about $9.4 million last year, and the newly enacted solar energy production tax. This is new from last year's legislature, and this is the first year that we will be administering those taxes. And finally, two special programs that the state-assessed property section administers. The pollution control exemption is one. This applies to property primarily used to reduce or control air, water, or land pollution. This applies to a lot of the electric utilities in the state of Minnesota, as well as the sliding scale market value exclusion, which provides for a reduced taxable market value for efficiency improvements to energy producing systems. There are six energy production facilities that receive this exclusion right now. Three receive a 100% reduction in market value on their efficiency property. I will turn this over to Mr. Ouellette, who will talk about our last three major functions, aid and credit payments, data and information management, and research and analysis.
Thank you, Ms. Fish. Mr. Ouellette, if you'd introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Eric Ouellette with the Department of Revenue's Property Tax Research Section. One of the main functions of the division is to pay aid, property tax aid and credit programs, including some of the major ones that you see listed here, local government aid to cities, county program aid, police and fire state aid, the new aquatic invasive species prevention aid that goes to counties, as well as township aid. And the last two are new in the last couple of years. There's about 10 state aid programs. These are some of the largest ones, though. County program aid is about $205 million a year. Town aid, $10 million a year. Local government aid, $507 million a year. And all other state aids that we pay, about $150 million a year. These are generally payments to local governments, and they're most of them are done in July and December of each year, but there are some other miscellaneous payments that go out at other times during the year. We also calculate and pay credits. That's a reimbursement to local governments for credits that you've all granted to certain property taxpayers. So the property taxpayer who gets a credit pays less property tax than what would otherwise be their share, and then that means the local governments are collecting less property taxes than what they asked for when they certified their levies. The state then reimburses the local governments for those revenues through these credit programs. The largest one is the Agricultural Homestead Market Value Credit, which is now about, I think, 30-some-odd million dollars a year, and it was increased last year and actually had a supplemental payment that we mailed out last fall to qualifying agricultural homesteads. Also, county conservation credits and disaster credits are other programs where the law gives a tax break to certain property tax owners, and then the state reimburses the local governments for the foregone revenue. We have other other state payments that we make that are not exactly aid or credit programs. There's the payment in lieu of taxes program that we administer in partnership with the Department of Natural Resources. They give us all the acreage data necessary, and then we reimburse counties for this program, which gives state dollars for property in counties that is owned by the state and therefore not paying property taxes. There's also a taconite aid program. And we do have a payment to individuals, the Sustainable Forest Investment Act program, where we give incentive payments to forested land for where there's good management of the forest lands. Our next major function is data and information management, and John Hagen alluded to this. This is a really important backbone to just about everything else that we do, where we collect a whole lot of data from counties, and we use that data to both implement the laws as well as to report on the property tax system to you all, and your staff relies on this data as well. Currently, we collect data about property values and taxes from counties in an aggregated form. We get summary data by jurisdictions or portions of jurisdictions. There's 9 different separate abstracts that get sent to us each year that contain different data about different parts of the property tax system. Some is on assessments, some is on taxes, some are on special programs like tax increment financing. Importantly, though, as Mr. Hagen mentioned, we are transitioning this data collection. We're doing a complete reengineering of how we collect the data to collect parcel level data. So we'll get all this data at a much more detailed micro level, which will really enhance our ability to analyze what's going on in the property tax system and report on it, as well as to provide oversight on compliance of the administration of the property tax laws. That's a multi-year project we're working with the counties on, and our first parcel data is still over a year away. Our second major reengineering that we've undertaken in the last several years is our Certificate of Real Estate Value, our Electronic Certificate of Real Estate Value Project, or ECRV. Traditionally, we've collected data about every real estate transaction in the state on it. It's a form that you've all filled out if you've been, or your title company has, if you've been involved in a real estate transaction. A copy of that is sent to the county, and a copy comes to the department. And we use that data to analyze the sales, which I'll talk about in a little bit. In the last couple of years, we've transitioned from a paper form to an electronic form. And this is a form that has to go through a whole lot of steps, so it was a major project to get that done electronically, but it's been a huge, it'll be a huge efficiency for the department and the counties when it's fully implemented. We use property sales data for a number of duties. We use it for determining agricultural market values in consultation with the University of Minnesota. That's a piece of the Green Acres program. We also use it for research reports and revenue estimates. And then, as Andrea mentioned, Ms. Fish mentioned, sales ratio studies. The main use of sales data is our sales ratio studies, and these are very complicated studies where we compare the sales price and the assessed value of property throughout the state every year. And we use these studies for multiple reasons. As Andrea mentioned, we use it for equalizing assessments to the State Board of Equalization. So if we see a pattern in a jurisdiction where property is selling for a whole lot more than what the assessor has it valued for, we'll work with them to increase the values to ensure that there's relatively equalized valuations across the state, or reductions as well. We also use it to adjust tax bases for differences in assessment levels when we distribute state aids. So there isn't an incentive, say, in the local government aid program to have low assessments to get more aid. Because we equalize using sales ratio studies, we're sure that there isn't an incentive in the program to lowball assessments to appear more needy to get more aid from state programs.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ouellet, there's a rumor running around my area when it comes to, because we've all been reassessed this year, that the Department of Revenue tells assessors what they must use in their values of property. Is that rumor based on the fact that you have these sales ratio studies and they have to use those in addition to other information? Would you clarify that? Because this rumor is rampant in my area, and I'm trying to figure out what's going on, and I can have a private conversation with you, too.
Mr. Rillon.
Mr. Chair and Representative Erickson, yes, the statutes require us to hold the State Board of Equalization and to look at the differences between sales and assessments, and if the assessments that the assessors are setting are very different than the results of the study, then we do give them guidance that forces them to change their assessments. So there's that feedback loop that we follow. And I'd be happy to talk to you offline in more detail about how that works.
And Mr. Ouellet and Representative Erickson, we're going to try to focus next week's hearing around assessments. So, Mr. Ouellet, if you could come in and be part of that discussion. I know there's people from around the state and members. If you know people in your districts or neighboring districts that have questions about the assessment process and how it works, please invite them to come and testify at the hearing next week, but we haven't completely framed that out, but we want to focus it around assessments, and maybe we'll have to work in a bill too somewhere that I know Representative Carlson was here. We're going to try to get his bill in either next time or the time after. Sorry to interrupt. Thank you, Representative Erickson. And Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ouellet, you mentioned quickly your department sends out the PILT payments. And just a quick question, as I understand, those payments go directly to our counties, and from there they're distributed. But I hear from our schools or some townships that they don't feel are getting their fair share. Are there rules in place as to how those funds are distributed, or is it up to the counties?
Mr. Ouellet.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, there is statutory guidance for how the PILT is distributed to townships, I can't recite it off the top of my head. Maybe Mr. Hines can jump
in. We will try to get into that at a future date as well. But the answer is it's statutory. I remember being in that area, digging in that myself. There's a couple of different calculations depending. Mr. Ouellet.
Members of the committee, the last major function is the research and analysis, and this is the section that I supervise. One of our main functions is the one that Ms. Schill talked about earlier, is preparing revenue estimates for bills that affect the property tax system, where we identify costs or savings to the state's general fund and where we can taxpayer impacts. We also are required by statute to identify whether a proposal makes the property tax system more or less understandable, efficient, equitable, stable, competitive, and responsive. So you'll see that information on the back of every revenue estimate for a property tax bill. We also forecast the state property tax aids, credits, and refunds. So the big state forecasts that come out twice a year, we contribute numbers to that in the property tax aids, credits, and refund area, as well as the state property tax on commercial, industrial, and cabin property. And we provide information about the property tax system, such as mandated studies. We're currently working on one on energy production systems that will be out later this session. So when you, through law, tell us to do a study, that's what we do. We also provide information on property tax refunds. And one study in particular that I just want to highlight is the property tax burden reports, sometimes referred to as the BOSS reports. This is a project we do where we analyze homestead property tax burdens as compared to the incomes of the people who live in those homesteads. And this is just a sample of the sorts of information that's in there. This table shows for all homesteads in the state for 2011 what their income range was and what their what the median property tax burden was before the property tax refund and after the property tax refund. So a couple things that this chart shows nicely is if you look from top to bottom, it shows how the homestead property taxes are regressive. Generally, people in with lower incomes pay a higher share of their income in homestead property taxes. The other thing that it shows, if you look from left to right, is how effective the property tax refund is in mitigating that regressivity. Homeowners whose income is between $10,000 and $30,000 had a before property tax refund burden of over 6% of their income, but after collecting the property tax refund, which is income tested, the median burden is down to 3.6%. At the higher income levels, the property tax refund has little or no impact because they're not at higher income levels, you're not eligible for the property tax refund program. So that's just one sample of the sorts of information you can get from our research reports. It's a little teaser there. So those are our main functions. To wrap up, I just say we do have a lot more information on our website, and all of us who you've been introduced to today are available for questions as well. So with that, we'll field any questions you have.
Thank you, Mr. Rillette and Ms. Fish. I think we have time, members, for one question. I've got a couple announcements, and Representative Quam.
Just a quick, you had the impact by income for property owners. Do you have similar data for the renter's credit?
Mr. Rillette.
If you could give that.
Mr. Chair and members, we are not able to do as detailed of analysis on renters because we can't connect the renters as well with the property that they live in and how much property taxes might be applied to the building that they live in. We do a general study. We do an overall statewide study of what the percent of rent is that renters generally pay in property taxes, and there's a memo that I can distribute to the committee if that's of interest.
That would be great. Thank you, Mr. Rillette. Members, we have time for maybe one more question if anybody's got a burning one. Otherwise, I'm sure we will hear from and interact with these fine folks again. Thank you very much for coming today, and we look forward to talking to you in the future.
Thank you all.
Members, a couple announcements. First of all, there's an item, and thank you to somebody from House Research and Fiscal Staff. Somebody prepared a nice flyer in our packet to outline which of the fiscal staff and research folks to talk to for particular issues. So it's all in one nice sheet for you there. Keep that handy. I want to talk a little bit about these listening sessions that we have coming up. We have one coming up tomorrow night and then one coming up on Saturday. And I know the discussion, Representative Dabney, came up on the floor yesterday. I want to give a little background, talk about where we're at with these next two sessions and then what to look for going forward. First of all, just a little background. Between the election and the beginning of session, I've had a number of members come up to me and talk to me about the importance of property taxes in their district and what they're hearing from their constituents, and encouraged me to come out after I was named chair of the committee. I obliged and am very willing to go out to those and any others that express that interest within Representative Lencheski within time, of course, available time. But I offered to them that I would do that. And then before session started, I was talking with some of the members of the committee. I sat down with Representative Dabney in his office and suggested, well, you know, this is a good idea. Why don't we have figure out how to have members of the committee also come out so that we can get more people involved in these? And so I went to staff, talked to nonpartisan staff upstairs and says, okay, how do we do this? We don't want to make all of these formal meetings, but my intention was to simply reach out and include more people in these meetings without incurring expenses and making it unwieldy. Of course, we had the discussion on the floor yesterday, which was somewhat of a surprise to me. what we're going to do this week is we have posted these last two, or these first two meetings, the only two meetings we're going to do as a committee, on the website, and they have, you should have received the posting in the last day or so. These are going to be official hearings. Whether or not we have a quorum is not important. They are posted, and members will be eligible for per diem. Mr. Rubis will be coordinating transportation to each of them, so if you would like to hop in the van or pickup truck or car or whatever Mr. Rubis puts together, I'm sure he'll have better accommodations than my pickup truck, by the way, members. Which is important, but if you could talk to him by the end of the day, he will find you a nice, comfortable seat, and we will head to those particular listening sessions. Again, the details on those are: the first one is tomorrow evening at 7 p.m. I'm trying to get this off the top of my head, in Stewartville at the Civic Center in Stewartville. The second one is 10 a.m. on Saturday, I believe, in Albert Lee at a coffee house, I think, there. So hopefully everybody can join us. Look forward to that. So what are we going to do going forward? We were in the process of developing additional meetings, and then when this cumbersome approach came up, it was my decision to suspend the planning of those meetings and the involvement of committee members in those meetings. I will go back to the way I was going to do them, and I will go out to those meetings with those individual members on my own and become listen to what they have to say. I would encourage all of you to do similar meetings in your districts, and if you have, as members of the committee, invitations from other members of the House or anybody to come out and listen to them, I'd encourage you to do similar meetings. I think this approach of listening to people is important. I talked to a number of people last night who are going to be at the one in Stewartville. I was actually made it down and back to Rochester for another meeting. They are encouraged that the legislature is reaching out and lending them an ear on a topic that's very important to them. So that's what we're going to do going forward. We will suspend those efforts, and those invitations that have been extended to me, I will fulfill myself as I originally intended to, and we'll do our best job without incurring additional expenses of the taxpayers of Minnesota to go to listen to them, and endeavor to listen to as many people as we can, and I encourage you to do the same. So, anyway, questions folks have? Representative Hertaus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to comment with regard to the flow sheet that we saw. If we could get some of those printed today to bring along to the session tomorrow, preferably in the 4 foot by 8 foot size, and we can distribute them as posters. But I think it would be helpful for any attendees to understand, or at least try to understand, the complexity of our tax system.
Okay, the Department of Revenue people, can you help us out? Awesome, thank you. Okay, members, with that, meeting's adjourned.